Hi, it's Robin Young. Thank you for listening to Here and Now. If you love this show, thank you again. And you may also love other great podcasts and shows and the journalism brought to you by NPR. When you support your local public radio station, it helps us keep our program going and helps NPR create new ones. So the best way to keep both Here and Now and NPR strong is to donate to your station. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give, then share why you did using the hashtag WhyPublicRadio. Thanks.
Arizona Senator John McCain said today that he will support the Republican tax overhaul. McCain said the bill was far from perfect, but it would boost the economy and provide tax relief to middle-class families. On the Senate floor this morning, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell signaled he may now have enough support to pass the bill, and a vote could come as soon as tonight.
This is our chance to deliver relief to hardworking American families and help the middle class get ahead. It's our opportunity to overhaul our complex tax code and shift our economy into high gear.
But the tax bill, as we now know, isn't just about taxes. It's also a health care bill. Julie Rovner is chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She joins us now for more on that. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Jeremy.
And everyone would be affected by a provision in the Senate bill that would do away with the Affordable Care Act requirement that all Americans have health insurance or pay a fine. What happens if that makes it into law?
Well, of course, technically, they're not getting rid of the mandate because they can't do that in this bill, but they would reduce the fine to zero, which would effectively get rid of it. It would most immediately affect the 17 million people who buy their own insurance. The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that it would result in 13 million fewer people having insurance, some of them because they don't want it. They're only buying it because of the fine, but also some because prices would go up if really only healthy people drop out of the market and only sick people sign up. And the CBO has also estimated that premiums would rise about 10% a year more than they would otherwise. For most people who get their insurance either through the government or through their workplace, the elimination of the mandate penalty wouldn't have very much of an impact.
But Maine Republican Susan Collins was worried about the impact of this, and she said this morning she wants measures to address that before any vote on the Senate tax bill. She's in favor of a bill proposed by Senators Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray. Remind us what that would do.
Well, that bill would restore the federal funding for these, they're called cost-sharing reductions, subsidies for the lowest-income people who buy their own insurance to help them pay their out-of-pocket spending. The problem with that is that it's almost too late to do that. President Trump cut those off. But in the meantime, after President Trump stopped paying them, there was a workaround developed by states and insurance companies. And basically, lower-income people are getting the discounts. Insurance companies are getting paid back one way or another. So putting them back probably wouldn't have much of an impact on ameliorating what the CBO said would be the result of getting rid of the individual mandate.
So do you expect that senators will go along with Alexander Murray as part of this tax cut plan?
Well, they could. Of course, it's not going to be in the tax cut plan.
Right.
The idea is that they would do it separately. But it's unlikely that the House would go along. And B, as I said, things have changed in the months since they put this together, and it's not clear what it would do. I think Susan Collins also wants a separate bill that would involve reinsurance, make it easier for insurance companies with very high-cost patients to get paid back. That might have a little bit more of an impact. But again, hard to tell if that could get through the House or the Senate.
What are the impacts on Medicare and Medicaid, if any, from the tax cut package?
Well, this is kind of interesting. Because a big chunk of the tax cut is not paid for and would add to the federal deficit, it would trigger a separate law called the PAYGO law from 2010 that would require major cuts to major programs. Now, the amount that could be cut from Medicare is limited to 4%, but that would still be a $25 billion cut every year for 10 years. Medicaid is not part of that. Medicaid is exempt from those cuts. But there is this perception that if Republicans manage to push this bill through, including this adding a $1.5 trillion to the deficit, there will be more pressure to cut programs like Medicaid. So there wouldn't be an immediate impact the way there could be to Medicare. But indeed, both of those programs could well find themselves on the chopping block in fairly short order.
There's another provision in the House plan, an elimination of the deduction for medical expenses. What impact do you see that having if it's included in the final version?
Well, about 9 million filers use the medical expense deduction. In order to use it, your medical expenses have to be more than 10% of your adjusted gross income. So we're talking for most taxpayers in the thousands of dollars, often in the tens of thousands of dollars. And these are people who have a relative getting long-term care, may have a child with a disability, may themselves have a serious chronic disease for which treatment is expensive beyond what their health insurance pays. You know, what the Republicans say is that, well, we're doubling the standard deduction, so these people don't need this medical expense deduction. But for the people who take it, it's way, way more than they would get in a doubled standard deduction. And the AARP, among other groups, is very, very concerned about doing away with the medical expense deduction. It's a small number of people, but it's a very large need and would have a very big impact.
That's Julie Robner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, thank you as always.
You're most welcome.
Well, many Brits are responding with anger at President Trump today because of his retweets yesterday of anti-Muslim images originally posted by the far-right British group Britain First. Here's Labour Party MP Stephen Doughty today in the House of Commons.
By sharing it, he is either a racist, incompetent, or unthinking, or all three.
The videos were originally posted by Jada Franson, a leader of the ultra-nationalist Britain First, which was born out of the British National Party. One video was described as showing a Muslim migrant attacking a Dutch boy using crutches. But the Dutch embassy in the U.S. tweeted out, "Facts matter. The perpetrator was born in the Netherlands, not a migrant, and he completed a sentence under Dutch law." Another video from 2011 shows a man smashing a statue of the Virgin Mary. And the third shows someone being pushed from a building, but it has nothing to do with an extremist attack. It's from the riots in Egypt in 2013. The perpetrators were prosecuted. One was executed. BBC political correspondent Rob Watson joins us from London. Rob, tell us more about the reaction there.
Well, you know, there's that phrase, I'm sure you have it in the US too, the way that we have it here, a Twitter storm. And in many ways, that really means that it's not a serious row at all. But this time, you know, a Twitter storm has really translated into a genuine diplomatic incident. And I guess I'd sum it up with two words, amazement and anger. As amazement that a president should behave in that way towards a British prime minister, naming her in a tweet.
Well, you're talking about the tweets that were exchanged yesterday by Prime Minister Theresa May and Donald Trump. She said something about this was wrong to do. In fact, she repeated that again today. Let's listen. Here she is speaking in Amman, Jordan.
The fact that we work together does not mean that we're afraid to say that when we think the United States have got it wrong, and to be very clear with them. And I'm very clear that retweeting from Britain First was the wrong thing to do.
When she said this yesterday, Rob, the president of the United States tweeted back at her, "Don't focus on me, focus on the destructive radical Islamic terrorism that is taking place within the UK. We're fine."
And it is, of course, a crushing moment, really, for Theresa May. And that is because if you think about it, she had put her Brexit eggs into the Washington basket. I mean, it's felt that the Britain voting to leave the European Union meant this pivot away from Brussels and a pivot towards an ever closer relationship with Washington. And I think this will go down as the moment when her judgment will have been seriously called into question, because, of course, there were a lot of people at the time saying you could see the kind of man he is, you should be careful. And so now Theresa May is trying to distance herself, not from the US as a country, but from the administration. But I think a lot of people would say, too late, the damage is done.
Well, give us more context for the anger. It's not just because the videos are largely wrong. They're not what they purport to be. But Britain has a huge Muslim population, the Muslim mayor of London, Muslim MPs, but also recent attacks. This is a serious issue.
Absolutely. You know, I said that the reaction here could be summed up in two words, amazement that the president had behaved in this way in terms of his attitude to the prime minister, but anger. And that anger is really a sense that these retweets had harmed, the president's actions had actually harmed the battle against Islamic extremism. In the little emergency debate that they had in Parliament that you got a flavour of there, I mean, British politicians are just genuinely appalled at the president's intervention.
Well, here's another response from Brendan Cox, whose wife, the MP Jo Cox, we remember, was murdered by a right-wing extremist who shouted Britain First, again, the name of this extremist group in Britain, before killing Jo Cox. After President Trump tweeted out, "We're doing fine," Brendan Cox tweeted at him, "You have a mass shooting every single day in your country. Your murder rate is many times that of the UK. Your healthcare system a disgrace. You can't pass anything through a Congress that you control. I'd focus on that." So again, this level of anger. Briefly, how big is Britain First? How important are they?
Well, that, of course, is the other reason why people are angry. Britain First is a very, very fringe, far-right, anti-Muslim group. But, of course, it has this bigger social media presence, something like nearly 2 million likes on Facebook. But, of course, the reason why there's so much anger here is that to give this unabashedly anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant group such a fantastic boost by retweeting it when you've got 44 million followers, I mean, that's why people here are in such a stew.
Is it fair to say it would be the equivalent of the Prime Minister of Britain tweeting out something from the KKK about American blacks?
I think that's not a bad way to do the comparison. I suppose, if anything, Britain First is even less well-known in the UK than the KKK is in the United States. But yes, I mean, it is pretty much along those lines.
And so what do you think? There's a long-standing invitation for the president to make a state visit. Is that in jeopardy?
Well, the prime minister was pressed about that, and she said that the invitation had been extended and accepted, but that a date had not yet been set. I heard one conservative source say something which I think is perhaps a good point to end on. He said that nobody inside Downing Street or in Buckingham Palace was reaching for their diaries right now.
Rob Watson, BBC political correspondent in London. Rob, thanks as always.
Good to be with you.
That latest North Korean missile launch has raised new concerns about the possibility of war. Here's Nikki Haley, U.S. Ambassador to the UN, speaking at yesterday's emergency meeting of the Security Council.
If war does come, it will be because of continued acts of aggression like we witnessed yesterday. And if war comes, make no mistake, the North Korean regime will be utterly destroyed.
But if war comes, will it be authorized? Now, every president is authorized to respond to an attack on the U.S. But earlier this month, Republican Senator Bob Corker was so concerned about the president launching a preemptive nuclear strike, he convened a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing, which concluded there was no legislative way to stop one. The following week, the current head of U.S. Strategic Command, General John Hyten, said he would resist what he called an illegal order from President Trump to launch nuclear weapons. But then we spoke with Bruce Blair, a former nuclear missile launch officer. He told us it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to stop a president from launching nuclear weapons once ordered.
General Hyten and Strategic Command would receive the order at the same time. If they felt that it was a really bad call or illegal and they wanted to try to override it, they could try to transmit a termination order, but it would be too late.
Well, our next guest disagrees that it has to get to that. He says there is a legislative solution, and it's right under lawmakers' noses. Bruce Ackerman is a law professor at Yale. He's also assisting in a case before the courts involving Army Captain Nathan Smith, who's questioning President Obama's airstrikes against ISIS in Syria in 2014. And Bruce joins us now from New Haven. Bruce, welcome back.
Pleasure to be here.
And now, you know, people might be saying, wait a minute, we've talked about this before. There are those war authorizations, you know, authorizations for the use of military force. Two of them. One was passed in 2001 and 2002 to fight al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And every president since has used them. But those were born out of the War Powers Act of 1973, which you say is what lawmakers should be looking at. So have a little history lesson here, Professor. Remind us what the War Powers Act of 1973 was.
The War Powers Act of 1973 passed in as the Vietnam War was coming to a close, was a self-conscious effort by Congress to rein in unilateral presidential war making, and it established a very strict schedule. Presidents could engage in military actions for 60 days, but if they failed to gain majority approval within that 60 days, they had to terminate their military operations within the next 30. This act applies not only to actual bombing or such things, but to any situation in which hostilities are imminent. The threat of a preemptive nuclear attack is imminent.
Let me just jump in to underscore this. President Nixon at the time bitterly resisted this. He felt he could veto this. Congress passed the act over his veto. They said that the Constitution gave the right to Congress to oversee war efforts. And so they have this 60-30 requirement under the War Powers Act. 60 days for a president to make his case and then 30 days for him to unwind it if Congress turns it down.
And President Nixon, even in his veto, did not challenge the 60-30-day calendar. And President Carter, in 1980, issued an opinion that has never been withdrawn, asserting that the 60-day timetable was constitutional. Even John Yoo, in his notorious opinions for the Bush administration in the aftermath of 9/11, never repudiated this.
So let me ask you something else about what you just said. Are you also saying that Nikki Haley triggered those 60 days with her comments at the UN?
Yes. And I would say, actually, President Trump, in his United Nations speech on September 19th, triggered the 60 days because Nikki Haley is just repeating what President Trump in his speech said on that very day, on September 19th.
In his speech at the UN, to remind people, he warned Kim Jong-un that he would have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea if the regime didn't halt its nuclear weapons and ballistic missile program. So you're saying it was at that moment that the 60 days was actually triggered. But what is supposed to happen when it is triggered? What's Congress supposed to do?
The statute provides a special peremptory procedure. Senator Corker's Committee on Foreign Relations has the right to propose an AUMF and put it directly onto the floor of Congress.
And again, the AUMF is the authorization for the use of military force.
That's right. And that authorization could say, we hereby forbid the president from inaugurating a preemptive nuclear attack. And if the Senate votes for an AUMF that bans the president from engaging in nuclear preemptive activity, it must go before the House. Moreover, the House is already indicating increasing dissatisfaction with the president's expansive readings of the now more than 10-year-old 2001 and 2002 authorizations. The AUMFs of 2001-2002 have been used in ways which, as you suggested, Captain Smith is challenging now before the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia.
So they can also be called, frankly, the authorizations against the use of military force because they can be used to restrict military force, as you just said. But tell us more about Captain Nathan Smith. He's an intelligence officer during Operation Inherent Resolve. That was the war against ISIS, the umbrella term for it. And in his suit, he's claiming that then-President Obama did not have the authorization to launch an open-ended war against ISIS using the war authorizations of 2001 and 2002 for fighting al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and fighting Saddam Hussein in Iraq. He was charged with doing some of these strikes in Syria and, as a strict constitutionalist, was torn because he wants to follow orders, but he wants them to be the right orders. So tell us more about what he's saying in his lawsuit.
The fact of the matter is that ISIS, and everyone agrees about this, only came into existence in 2004. The authorization for the use of force in 2001 came about this way. President Bush first asked Congress to authorize force not only to attack al-Qaeda and organizations that were responsible for the tragedy of 9/11, but also to preempt future attacks and to attack any terrorist organization that would come into existence in the future. This was explicitly rejected. And so here is Captain Smith. He's looking for guidance. Is the president actually executing the law? That's his that's the president's constitutional responsibility. And the president has given him no legal arguments. If this is permitted to stand and President Trump is continuing the war, where there still is a war going on against ISIS in Syria and Iraq, but we're winning it, if the Court of Appeals and ultimately the Supreme Court would permit a mere assertion to be enough, President Obama and President Trump will have created a precedent not only for President Trump, but for future presidents to say that there are any, that there is a terrorist organization and it's somehow or another linked to ISIS, which is somehow or another linked to the organizations that actually planned and executed the 2001 agreement. But we're not going to give you any public evidence of this, of course, because it's all confidential. This, it would be, if the court doesn't intervene, it will authorize the forever war. But even then, it wouldn't authorize North Korea. It wouldn't authorize North Korea because nobody claims that Kim Jong-un has any relationship whatsoever to terrorist organizations. He's in control of a sovereign state. That's the problem.
So, Professor, just to be clear, you've pointed out, by the way, we should say that the Trump administration has followed the letter of the law in the past when they asked for permission for the strikes following the chemical attacks in Syria. But what should happen now? Is it solely the job of the Congress to be listening to the president's words and feel they hear the words that should trigger authorization for the use of military force and write it up themselves? Or is it a president's job to go to Congress and to ask for an authorization for the use of military force under the War Powers Act?
Both should occur. At the same time, I very much hope that the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia will decide the case in the next 2 or 3 months in a way that puts the country on alert. We have a constitutional crisis on our hands, and all branches of government have obligations to uphold the Constitution, which makes Congress, rather than the president, the ultimate judge of war and peace, and uphold the rule of law under the War Powers Act. So it isn't either or, it's both and. And, of course, the more a concerned public raises this issue, the more quickly they'll move.
Bruce Ackerman, professor of law and political science at Yale. Thank you so much, Professor, for speaking with us.
Thank you.
A vote on the Senate tax plan could come as soon as tonight, and support for it appears to be growing. So let's talk about its potential economic impact with Mike Regan. He's senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So the Dow today broke another record, going above 24,000 for the first time. Investors seem to like the idea that this tax cut bill is likely to pass.
Yes, absolutely. Especially as it picks up steam this week, Senator John McCain endorsing it today really helped propel that stock rally. So definitely a lot of optimism that this will pass, at least on the part of investors.
And investors often making bets on the future. So what does that stock market rally tell us about what might happen to the economy? Or are they looking at individual businesses and how they'll benefit?
Well, from the economy side, the estimate from the White House's Council of Economic Advisors is that the corporate tax cut alone could boost growth to the 3-5% range and boost the average household income by $4,000 a year. But these have been described as back-of-the-envelope calculations. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of skepticism surrounding the veracity of these numbers. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has called the numbers, quote, fake math. And there's really a lack of sort of an official analysis of this plan. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is getting a lot of criticism today after the New York Times put out a story explaining how he had promised the Treasury would release a detailed analysis of the economic impact of the bill. And as of yet, they haven't done so. And everyone's still waiting for the Joint Committee on Taxation to release their report. A lot of economists are very reluctant to put a firm estimate on the impact because there's still so many questions about how the House and Senate bills will be reconciled.
But when you talk about the possibility of 3-5% economic growth, we just saw the quarterly GDP growth at 3.3%. Unemployment is down to 4.1%. So why would we need tax cuts to stimulate the economy right now?
Well, many would argue that we certainly don't. Corporate profits, for example, are at a record share of GDP. I think the White House's selling point is that this is a long-term issue and not something that's needed urgently, although Republicans certainly are acting urgently to pass it. To me, what's Possibly the most controversial part of the bill, however, is they're considering the notion that if deficits do grow to be more than they expect them to, which presumably would happen if economic growth slows, then they're considering actually triggering tax increases if the deficit is bigger than expected. And that would occur theoretically right when the economy would need the stimulus, would need the opposite. So to me, it's surprising that isn't sort of a bigger sticking point.
Could be kind of a double whammy of bad news if you then have tax increases while the economy is struggling. But what about, just in the 30 seconds we have left here, what about what big deficits would do to interest rates?
Well, right. Obviously, the bigger the deficit, that means the more Treasury bonds that the U.S. has to sell to fund the deficit. And the more supply of bonds, the higher Treasury yields go. And those yields influence every interest rate out there that consumers and businesses pay. So theoretically, the bigger the deficit gets, the higher the interest rates potentially could go. And eventually, that could be a drag on growth, too.
Yeah, and maybe the housing market as well.
Michael
Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Every year, about 800,000 people in the U.S. have a stroke. The months that follow are seen as critically important. Generally, any improvements in speech, movement, and cognitive ability happen during the first 6 months. After that, any loss in function is thought to be permanent. But a neurosurgeon at Stanford has been testing a new adult stem cell therapy that has completely changed this thinking. Dr. Gary Steinberg is a professor and the chair of neurosurgery at Stanford. He's being honored for this work by the Smithsonian Magazine, which is presenting him with one of its American Ingenuity Awards. He joins us now. Dr. Steinberg, congratulations.
Thanks a lot, Robin.
Well, you have a lot to be happy about because from what we're reading, some of the patients you've worked with dramatically improve even years after their strokes. Stem cells. First of all, remind us what adult stem cells do.
So there are many types of stem cells, of course. Mm-hmm. Adult stem cells are one particular type. And they have the ability to turn into certain kinds of cells in the body. But the interesting thing in terms of what we did is that the cells don't actually integrate into the brain long term and become neurons to reconstitute circuits. What they do is to pump out very powerful growth factors, molecules, and proteins that enhance native mechanisms of recovery, such as new synapses of neurons that are there, new blood vessels, and they have a very profound effect on modulating the immune system. And in that way, what we believe they do is to turn the adult brain into a neonatal or infant brain, which has a lot of ability to recover after injury.
Well, and the overarching headline here is that the thinking had always been that after several months, whatever wasn't functioning was dead. You discovered it's dormant.
That's right. That was something we didn't expect. We were very pleased to see that the study in 18 patients showed that the transplant of these stem cells into the brain in chronic stroke patients was safe and feasible, but we were stunned to find that the patients improved. Overall, three-quarters of the patient showed a what's called meaningful recovery over a course of 6 months, sustained at 12 months, and now we know it's sustained at 24 months. That means their life was made better, and we had a couple of miracle patients who showed very, very dramatic recovery.
Would one of them be Sonia Kuntz?
Yes.
Because she's just 31 years old. We've spoken quite a bit about strokes in young adults. In fact, let's take a second to talk about the two different kinds of strokes.
Yeah, so a stroke is a sudden disability in a neurologic body function due to disruption of blood flow to the brain. And about 87% of strokes are due to what are called ischemic type. That means there's a block in the blood vessel in the brain.
Like so, a blood clot.
That's right. And so glucose and oxygen can't get to the tissues and the tissues die. The other type, which is much rarer, is a hemorrhagic stroke that occurs in about 13% of patients. And that is when a blood vessel bursts in the brain, causing injury.
Well, and as we've been hearing on our program, and as you know, it can happen to someone as young as 31 years old. This was Sonia Kuntz. She had very little movement in her right arm or leg. And then you perform this procedure, drilling a tiny hole in her skull, and injecting her with the stem cells. So how did you know where to go?
So what we do is to attach what's called the stereotactic frame to the head. It's like a GPS system of guidance for the brain. And that allows us to implant the cells around the stroke with submillimeter accuracy. Then we make a little hole about the size of a nickel in the bone, and using a very fine needle, we transplant the cells into the area just surrounding the stroke, not directly in the stroke because that's a very inhospitable environment, but the cells survive just outside the stroke, and they somehow do their thing to resurrect the circuits.
Yeah, and you're not quite sure how, but just again to underscore here, these are not embryonic stem cells. That's very controversial because they come from early stage embryos that have been discarded. Again, these are adult stem cells, and they die off. It's not as if they stay. So you're saying they prompt something.
That's exactly right. They're not embryonic-derived. They're not fetal-derived. They're adult-derived from a donor bone marrow. Two donor patients provided enough cells to treat 18 patients in this trial. And the cells don't survive more than a month or two in the brain. But by secreting these very powerful proteins and molecules, they seem to resurrect the circuits that we used to think were dead or irreversibly injured. Now we know that they're viable. We just have to figure out how to rejuvenate them.
Well, and tell us, what happened for Sonia Kunz?
Well, Sonia was 2 years out from a stroke that affected her left brain, so she was unable to move her arm or hand at all. She could walk with great difficulty. She didn't want to get married because she felt she'd be embarrassed walking down the aisle, and you couldn't understand her speech. After we transplanted the cells, she made a dramatic and near miraculous recovery to the point she's walking well. She got married. She had a boy, a baby boy, 14 months ago who's doing very well. And her speech, while not completely normal, is very, very understandable.
Look, you know that right now millions of people are listening who have a loved one who's had a stroke and has not had recovery, or they themselves have had a stroke and had recovery. What are the cautions here?
Well, we're very excited about these results. However, we don't want to overpromise. This was an early phase study, only 18 patients. We just completed enrollment in a larger multi-center double-blind controlled study of 156 patients throughout the country, where a third of the patients do not get the cells. They only get a partial hole in the skull. And the only people who know are the seven or eight people in the operating room who did the procedure. So we'll have the results of this larger phase two study in about a year and a half. And if that confirms what we found in the first study, it would lead to a definitive phase three study of several hundred patients with controls. And if that's positive and shows benefit, we'll be able to commercialize the technique, and it'll become available for everybody.
This is amazing. I mean, when you step back and think about it, what are your thoughts?
Well, I'm shocked. To tell you the truth, even 10 years ago, we couldn't dream about recovering function in patients with neurologic disorders and disability. Now we know that those circuits, which we thought were irreversibly damaged or dead, are not. We just have to figure out how to resurrect them. And it may apply to disorders other than stroke, such as spinal cord injury, traumatic brain injury, and even degenerative diseases like Parkinson's disease, ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and maybe even Alzheimer's disease.
And by the way, I just want to mention, you're not sure why these areas die off or dormant or inhibited. But you've mentioned inflammation, that word that always creeps up, whether it's heart issues or now post-stroke. Just thoughts on that.
That's exactly right. So we don't know why these circuits are inhibited, but we hypothesize it's due to a chronic inflammation. And there's increasing evidence now that not just animals, but also people have inflammation that continues for years after a stroke. We think that the cell-secreted products that we put in are actually causing a response in the brain because we see a new abnormality on the MR scans that appear at a week and disappear at 2 months. And that temporary abnormality that appears then goes away is correlated in terms of its size with the recovery at 12 months and 24 months. So we're studying exactly what that is now in the laboratory. We think it actually is a beneficial form of inflammation that stimulates these circuits.
You know, we always end up saying, you know, I'm not a brain surgeon, but I, you know, whatever. You are a brain surgeon. With what you know Is there something that people can do to better improve their health or maybe avoid a stroke?
Well, sure. There are preventative measures which are very important, including controlling blood pressure, not smoking, eating a healthy diet. Exercise is key, avoiding obesity. Those are all generally good strategies to try to avoid a stroke. And then there's something you can't change very well, and that's the genetics, the genes you were born with.
Yeah. I was going to say, because Sonja Kruntz, the 31-year-old, terrific health and a stroke. Dr. Gary Steinberg, chair of neurosurgery at Stanford University. He's in Washington, D.C., to receive an award from the Smithsonian Magazine, one of its American Ingenuity Award winners this year, for his work using adult stem cells in post-stroke recovery. Dr. Steinberg, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Robin.
American Airlines is scrambling to deal with a possible pilot shortage during the holidays. The news came out yesterday that a glitch in the scheduling system allowed all American Airlines pilots to take time off at the end of December, and a lot of them did. Now the airline is offering to pay pilots time and a half to work those dates. Seth Kaplan is managing partner at Airline Weekly. He joins us now. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what happened here, and have you ever seen anything like it before?
Not quite like it, although you look around the world and there are some other similar examples, actually one going on right now in Europe. But at American, basically what happened here is, you know, sometimes technology, it's great when it works, helps solve a lot of problems, but it can really magnify a little mistake. And in this case, American did what it does every month, kind of looks ahead and generally sees some trips where pilots might be able to take the day off because it has reserve pilots looking for extra hours. These are full-time employees, but people who are lower on the seniority list. In this case, American, instead of sort of picking and choosing trips where somebody could take the day off, as you said, just let everybody off. It was a small mistake that became a big mess for the airline.
And they couldn't have just sent out a note to all the pilots that took the day off and say, all of these day off requests are now invalid. We're going back to, you know, you're all working unless you're given the day off.
Yeah, just kidding. No, yeah, that doesn't work like that. And so, yeah, they had to go to them and say, look, we will pay you time and a half, basically overtime pay for, in many cases, flying the same flights that they would have flown in the first place. I mean, that's what's going to end up happening here. You're going to have the same men and women on those same planes, but getting a little extra holiday bonus for doing that. So between that and those reserve pilots that American always has, you know, it seems like the problem is getting solved, but certainly at great expense to the airline, both in terms of the extra money it's having to pay for these pilots, plus, you know, some reputational damage here. I mean, you know, this is nothing that's going to bother them. It's going to hurt them in the very long term. But somebody today who's booking airline tickets, you know, American might look a little sloppy.
Yeah, we're seeing reports that the strategy that they have been using of offering this time and a half pay could be working, that there are now only a few hundred flights without pilots. But that's still a few hundred flights without pilots.
It is, but, you know, that's just sort of a couple of days into this mess now, and still with more than 2 weeks to go. So that number is probably going to get very close to zero, if not actually zero by time they get there. So, it seems like a sudden thing, having this all happen a couple weeks in advance. But in airline terms, when you think of the, you know, storms and things that come up with much shorter notice than that, actually gave them some amount of time to react. So in the end, this will probably be a really big embarrassment, and as I said, an expense for the airline, but not something it'll be a really big event. I mean, right now, if you're holding tickets on American, you're probably still more worried about, you know, a blizzard that we don't yet know about or
right,
something else later in the month than you are about this situation.
And how much would it cost them if they did have to cancel all these flights to deal with all those angry passengers as opposed to just paying the pilots more?
Yeah, well, that would cost more, both between the actual costs in terms of reaccommodating people, booking people on other airlines in some cases, and then the longer term reputational damage. The union initially said 15,000 flights. American sort of saying it was never really quite that high, but that would be like a really bad storm, but one that's all the airline's fault. You know, people understand, obviously, when weather causes things or, you know, just other things beyond the airline's control. But in this case, yeah, they had to do everything possible. And paying time and a half, they might not like doing it, but it's cheaper than the alternative.
We do hear about a lot of glitches at the airlines these days, that some of the biggest problems come from things like this.
Yeah, and what sort of happened is that the day-to-day mundane things that they do, they've actually gotten better at, partly aided by that same technology. So most of these airlines actually are more punctual than they used to be. Most of them are losing fewer bags on a day-to-day basis. But then, yeah, once in a while, you have something go wrong, and it goes really wrong in a way that you didn't have back when. You just couldn't do that kind of damage with by making a mistake on a piece of paper that you can with one keystroke now.
This does also bring up a bigger issue that we've talked about on this show before, which is that there's an overall pilot shortage right now, isn't there?
There is, and it's particularly important actually for the people flying smaller planes because those are, there's kind of a trickle-down effect here of it's now more expensive to become a pilot. You need a lot more hours than you used to. And so generally speaking, we're not talking about people flying the big jets at American, for example, and its competitors. But if you get on one of those smaller planes, those are the airlines, and some of them do fly for the bigger airlines like American, that are having a hard time staffing those right. flights. They're getting their hands around it, but still an issue. Absolutely, Jeremy.
Well, I hope American Airlines fixes this problem completely because I'm flying American at the end of December and I don't want that flight to be canceled. Seth Kaplan, managing partner at Airline Weekly, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Here and Now, a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.